Hi there, everybody. This is Armand DeMille.
And this is Roberta Maria Atti.
Here with you with The Positive Mind on WBAI 99.5 FM. On your dial, learning. Learning all the time. Learning. And today we're learning about why people sometimes have to be a little different than they are. Mm-hmm. And why people make believe they're different than they are, you know? So we're going to start off with a little bit of history and try to understand it in nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not only people do that, Armand. Animals do that a lot. In fact, let me see. Let me give you a few examples here. How about the wounded bird? The mother bird that pretends to be wounded, and she pretends to have a broken wing, and she crawls along the ground in front of a predator to distract the predator from the nest, where the nestlings would not be able to defend themselves, and she pulls the predator away, and then she flies away, hopefully. That's one. Another one could be the ball fish. I think it's called the ball fish. It's a tiny little fish, but when it gets scared, it swells up and it has all these spikes and it floats up and it becomes much bigger and scary looking, and it's designed to scare away a predator.
So there's two examples. In both cases, one is defense and the other is defense also. There are other cases where in nature the animals would want to be different than they are because they want to either get sex, which is to reproduce.
Like the peacock?
Well, I don't know if the peacock's only for sex.
Well, the peacock male, the plumage is, in fact, the plumage...
It's what attracts the female.
It's been determined that the plumage of a peacock, it really gets in the way of the bird's safety because it's difficult to fly with that long tail. It's difficult to run away. So it's actually only for the purpose of attracting a female.
Nature's frauds or nature's imposters include everything. I mean, it's very clear that what nature has decided is that you're good the way you are, and if you have to adapt yourself to get through, then that's okay too. In fact, it is the most adaptable that are the ones that survived. Yet when humans adapt their personality, we call it lying, cheating, fraud, imposters, and a whole bunch of other names, which kind of makes sense because humans kind of made a deal. And the humans said, look, we're not going to be animals anymore, so what we want to do is we want you to be who you are. But I'll give you an example. There is a wasp, one particular wasp, who only mates by female wasp will kind of fly around looking for this male wasp, and if he has a present of food, she'll have sex with him. So he knows this, and the way he has food is he doesn't go get something at the grocery store. He catches a fly, and he wraps the fly up in some kind of a little cocoon, and he presents it. And if the female sees the fly, she says, okay, mate with me, and then she eats the fly. Right? This is early working in the blue light district. And then, so then what happens is the male, knowing that that's how he's going to get his goodies, he starts to wrap up little pieces of pebbles, and he makes believe it's a fly. And so now he has to present to this female wasp that, look, I got food for you, and then she has sex with him, and then she eats it, and it turns out to be a piece of dirt. Isn't this much like what a woman goes through when she meets a guy at a bar? You know, do you have a real fly in there, or is that a piece of dirt?
I was going to say,
and I'm not going to find out till theater. You only get the news later, which is why internet dating is becoming so popular, because you get more time to learn more news. We'll get to that a little later. So in nature, there are three motives. One motive is to defend yourself. The other motive is to get food, is to aggress, is to dominate. A tiger has stripes. He doesn't need the stripes, but the stripes make him somewhat invisible in the stalking grass, so you can't see him. So nature gives us camouflage. alterations. There are animals that could change their color. There are animals that change their spots. You know.
Yes, and it's all done. I guess we call it an adaptation when it becomes a permanent alteration of the original looks. And then when it's just a temporary change, one that serves a purpose of misleading another, then we call it a fraud. But usually when we talk about frauds, there is a negative judgment on it, especially in regards to humans, meaning that we think it shouldn't be. It's not right to pretend to be someone other than who we are, that to want to look stronger, more powerful, more, or younger, or older, or, you know, whatever. And what Armand and I are saying, I guess, is that, well, it's everywhere in nature, and it's a strategy that actually seems to work really well for animals all across the board in a number of situations. It's very successful.
The ones that have survived the most are the ones who are most adaptable and most capable of fraud. You know, in other words, if you're going to be a fish that it wants to eat other fish, you could get quiet and be down in the water, and you learn to make believe you're some kind of a weed, you know, or you hide under the sand. It is the ability of flexibility of misrepresenting yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Then, of course, we go from humans to the real subject of today.
From animals, right?
You know, and plants, by the way, who also imitate.
Oh, yes. What about that one that pretends to be a cadaver?
Uh-huh.
A cadaver?
Yeah.
Cadaver. That smells like a rotten body to attract flies.
And then it eats the flies.
And it eats the flies.
Well, let's talk about all the flowers.
Yeah, flowers.
This is kind of amazing, isn't it, Roberta?
Well, yeah. I mean, all flowers are deceitful in the sense that they're really designed to trick insects into getting that plant to reproduce. So all flowers have that purpose of creating a fraud.
Well, how is a rose a fraud? What's it supposed to look like?
Well, it's not so much that the rose, it's that any flower is designed either with the color or the scent or both to attract the insects that are around in that environment, because then an insect will go from flower to flower and pollinate flowers of the same species.
You know, what's really remarkable is orchids, because orchids are just made to imitate wasps. They look just like a wasp. So the thing from a distance, you know, there are many orchids that look just like the animal itself.
Yes.
And so what it does is it attracts it. In fact, all flowers, long ago, I mean, prehistoric man did not have a garden filled with tulips. He didn't, because tulips weren't very useful. But tulips learned that by being beautiful, they could convince humans to cultivate them.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we did a program about this, Armand. Yeah, flowers have a mind of their own. They kind of learned what humans like, the scent, the color, the combinations, and they have become better and better able to give us what we want from them so that we will keep them around and reproduce them abundantly. And it's amazing.
So let's say that phrase again. Scent, color,
mm-hmm.
What
combination of characteristics.
Which is exactly what young people do with each other. You want to present the scent? We have perfumes. We have powders. We have showers. We have cleanliness. We have oil. We have pheromones. The smell of something that will attract you. And if you don't like your own, what do? You use an underarm deodorant. What do? You put a fake smell on your body.
Sure.
If you don't like your breath, you brush your teeth. Not just to get rid of bacteria, but to correct the smell. You eat parsley, and when you eat garlic, to get rid of the smell of garlic. Do you know that parsley works?
Does it work, really?
Oh, 100%.
Are you talking about the little gels or
the
real parsley?
You can eat the little gels or real parsley. A handful of gel parsley you have to eat.
You know, Armand, I have to say, I think it depends on the person. On some people it works and some people it doesn't.
Other people, the garlic gets on their skin and it's just there.
Right, right.
Garlic-smelling people.
I think it's genetic.
I'm noticing many more garlic-smelling people nowadays.
I guess people are finally getting it, that it's okay to smell like garlic. It's not that much of a sin.
Hmm. So the way you smell is one. Now, appearance. People always fake their appearance.
Hmm.
I mean, I know people who refuse to look in a mirror, on a full-body mirror.
Yeah.
Because they are so used to correcting their appearance of themselves that when they look in a mirror, it looks dreadful. You know, if you wear the right black clothing, if you have, you know, your right everything toned down, you just don't want to see it up close.
Well, I know a woman in Italy who is not very tall. She's, I think, under 5 feet, and she will not wear ever any flat shoes, even in the house. You'll never see her wearing slippers, or she always has heels. If you think about it, heels are also a form of camouflage, because you're trying to look taller.
You're not only looking taller, but you're also shaping your calves and ankles. Your buttocks look stronger when you're wearing high heels, and it presents an illusion that you're powerless. You see, people with heels, the reason that I think most men found heels attractive is because the person can't run away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's the idea. So again now, why...
And that can be taken to the extreme of what they do in China.
Right, which is to actually cripple the child.
To cripple the feet so that the child really cannot even stand, let alone walk.
But we willingly do this to ourselves, and we're not saying you should not do it. I am not saying throw away your perfume, throw away your soap, throw away your high heels, and throw away everything, and live just a natural life, and smell like garlic if you want, and never brush your teeth. There's a man came by recently with a toothbrush. He had a very efficient toothbrush. He said, here's a toothbrush with which you never need toothpaste.
Yes, and you showed it to me.
Yeah, I showed it to you,
with
right?
With that metal, copper or something?
Some kind of coil or something. But the whole idea of it is, what do you do about your breath? Mm-hmm. You know, if you clean your teeth, you still somehow have some kind of a breath thing left
in there.
Well,
supposedly, if you don't have bacteria in your mouth, then you don't have bad breath. But I think that's a little naive, because I think some bacteria also live in the esophagus and the stomach. So
the idea here is to cover as much as you can. And we are not saying that it is not right, but this is an introduction to two things we're going to talk to you about today. Three things: fictitious disorder, variations of fictitious disorder, and the imposter syndrome. Now, these we talk about because these are all offshoots of the human flexibility to alter our presentation of ourself. And because we alter it, and because we have been encouraged to alter it, because truth was not too welcomed, because the real self is not too welcomed too often, people have done things to themselves.
Yeah, I guess they've taken this very successful idea to an extreme, whereby not only do they succeed in presenting an image that's different from the real self, they actually sometimes become convinced themselves that that's who they really are, right? I mean, sometimes they do, sometimes they don't, but it's
that's the point about fictitious disorder, which we're going to go to in a minute.
Right.
You know, and it's true. I mean, think of yourself as a child. Just to give you a little bit of background, we were talking about as children. What are the many things that humans do? You know, what are the many things that human children do? You know, at a child, if you feel sick, and you feel slightly sick, you wake up in the morning and you're not feeling right, and you don't want to go to school.
Or let's say that you may be feeling okay, but you really don't like to go to school because there's something in school that scares you. You're afraid you're going to get beat up, or there's a teacher you really don't like. So there's something there that you really don't want to deal with.
You got dance class that day, you know, and you're just not, you don't want to face it, right?
You may wake up okay, but the thought of having to face that one situation is so overwhelming that you know, your only way out is to pretend to be sick, so you may end up convincing yourself that you indeed you are sick, and you may end up starting with a stomach ache or a headache or a fever.
Even. Well, you bring up 2 points here. The one I said is you are sick. You have a beginning of a sickness. You don't feel good. You feel dysphoric. You feel a little out, a little bit out. So now you talk about another one, which is completely faking it. And we're going to talk about that, that there are two different ways of doing it. One way is faking it. And another way is looking at yourself and saying, oh, I don't feel good. And then you say to your mother, I don't feel good. I feel sick. And she says, let me feel your head. And she feels your head and she says, well, you don't have a temperature, and say, oh, my stomach really, really hurts. And now she has to determine, are you lying? Should you be sent to school? Have you done this recently? Are you allowed to stay out? You know, and can she allow you to stay out and not take care of you? Does she have to go to work? All of these factors get involved. So then she pushes on you a little, you know, are you sure you're going to, and you, if you're in that mood, you can actually make yourself sicker. You can make yourself, with a little bit of sickness, make yourself to the point where you could practically run a fever. So that you get permission to stay home. So you could either fake it or develop it.
But see, what I was saying, Armand, is that even, yes, even a child who is not faking it but has enough fear of what's in school, the fear itself could trigger all kinds of immune system activities that could lead to being sick, even though the child maybe on some level subconsciously knows that this sickness is, you know, an opportunistic nature, nonetheless, the child is feeling sick. It's not, the child is not faking it. It's a real discomfort, and it comes from this fear of that teacher or something.
Or whatever it is. So children...
Because, I just want to say one more thing, try this on a child in that situation. If you say to the child, oh, you're not feeling well, sure, you can stay home. And in fact, you know, I was going to go to the park and I wonder, the child immediately feels well. You know what I mean? The sickness disappears because now the immune system turns around and undoes the...
I understand. So, you know, what you're saying is now, once the child fakes it, the parent starts to fake, I was going to go to the park. And now we're getting far out into the different reaches of it. But my point about bringing up children is the following. A child has illness that they could play with, or a child has a real or imagined illness. That's what we're talking about. A child also, but as a child, there are many things you go through. You know, children fake their gender. They fake their age. Right? There are times that you don't want to be. When would you fake your gender, Roberta?
I think it's very convenient for girls to pretend to be boys when boys get to do things that girls are not allowed to do. Well, and vice versa, I guess. And, of course, a child will always pretend to be older because older children are allowed, have a lot more freedom.
Stick with the gender for a moment. The gender confusion, the fact that you would have a gender change where you would, let's say you were a young girl growing up with all boys. And tomboy is a perfect example of shifting your gender so that nobody focuses on it. Or let's say you're a young girl who's very developed very early on, and your breasts and your body become a target for a lot of boys. Very often a woman will play down, or a young girl will play down her sexuality to become asexual, even not if male. So this thing that we learn early on about our sexuality, about, and men, young boys, they have to hide the fact that they get perpetual erections, you know what I mean? They have to hide any kind of excitement. They have to kind of hide it back and put it away and make sure nobody sees it. So the camouflage of our sexuality becomes a big thing. A camouflage, what you began to say, camouflage of our age, because age becomes a big thing when you're little. You can't drink till you're 16, so you make up cards. You can't drive till a certain age, you know, or even as a child, how old are you? You know, I'm 6 next week. as opposed to I'm five, all has a great deal of meaning.
Right.
So we fake age. Now, we talk about all the different fakings that we have as children, that we eventually grow up, and sometimes you just grow up in such a way that you develop a thing called the imposter syndrome, which is where we'd like to start this discovery with you today.
Well, I think that for a child who grows up in an environment where there are a lot of expectations put on him or her, and, you know, maybe we could even go to the extremes of anorexia and all these body morphic, whatever the name is. But a child who feels that he or she is not okay, is not acceptable being him or her or herself, will learn to disguise under made-up self-descriptions, like I am stronger than I really am, or I pretend to be. I pretend to be very assertive and very smart and very this and very that, because then I'll be accepted and I'll be liked. But the point is that in the long run, these disguises end up becoming so ingrained in the personality that there's an enormous expenditure of energy for the upkeep of this charade, and then you know, it becomes like a thing that leeches energy out of the real being, that is, keeps trying to pop out and to express itself, but it can't because there's this made up persona that needs to be maintained.
But we're not saying that this is wrong.
No. We're not saying it's wrong. We're saying to some degree we all do this because there's so much social expectation to succeed, to be educated, to be successful, to be attractive, to be lean, to be, you know, to be all these things.
Let's talk about the imposter syndrome. You see, the imposter syndrome is a common syndrome. Now, this is a real thing that happens to people. It falls into three categories. Like Roberta says, you know, after a while, you're so used to making believe that you are something. You're more intelligent. You're more assertive. You know, people take self-assertive courses. They get to look a certain way, and you dress a certain way, and people believe certain things of you, that it takes a lot of energy to keep it going. Now, many people can do that. They can take all the energy and put it out to their artificial self or the self they present. But what happens is the following. After a while, when you achieve something and you get to a certain level of success or professional position, that you have, and nobody's discovered you for being other than you really are, you begin getting a feeling like you're a fake. And you believe, a person who feels this way would identify with a statement such as, I give the impression that I'm more competent than I really am. I'm often afraid that others will discover how much knowledge I don't have. Women who are in the business world have a high degree or report a great deal of the feeling of being imposters. They feel like they've positioned themselves and that in some way they feel like they're not truly the authority. Now, men also feel like imposters, but men in academia report the most amount of feeling like imposters. You know, people who are in the teaching professions or the teachers, they feel like real fakes. So when you feel like a fake, it doesn't mean there's anything wrong with you because you brought yourself up on this artificial self. But the imposter syndrome is something that grows to a point that you can become highly nervous, highly doubting yourself, and eventually get depressed. I talked about three different ways that it happens. One is feeling like a fake. The other is attributing your success to luck. That if you're lucky, a person with an imposter syndrome very often will say, I was just lucky. This aspect is, I got lucky this time, it was a fluke. Because you have a fear that you won't succeed the next time, you let people know, this was just lucky on my part, because you're afraid that you're going to be held responsible if you don't succeed the next time. And the third aspect is a tendency to downplay success and discount it. One with such feelings would discount an achievement by saying, you know, it's not a big deal. It's not important. One example of this discounting the fact that they made his by saying, I did well because it was an easy class to take. They're very often afraid to let other people see them as successful, even though, because they feel like they're imposters the whole time. It's not an all-or-nothing syndrome. Many of you probably could identify with a few statements, but not with others. Some people may identify with imposter feelings in some situations and not in others. Who is likely to have the imposter syndrome? People with lower self-esteem, people who didn't have that kind of environment, people in different professions, especially teachers, social scientists, people in academia, actresses, actors. They all tend to have imposter syndromes.
I guess there could be also an imposter syndrome pertaining to someone who's expected to look happy, to look cheerful, to look, you know, maybe, I think it has a lot to do with the way we grow up and the family we grow up with, where there are certain expectations. In some families that I know of, children are not allowed to cry. They're not allowed to be sad. They're not allowed to express sadness or disappointment. Or they're not allowed to leave food on the plate. They're not allowed to not be hungry. So then here's someone who learns to eat because it's wrong not to. So I think it has a lot to do with the expectations that a child perceives are the conditions by which the child will be loved and accepted for who he or she is. And being as adaptable as we are, as Armand was saying in the beginning, we, evolutionarily speaking, have learned to pretend to be something other than what we are when the need requires that we do so. But when we take that to an extreme, it can become confusing to the person who is doing it, let alone to the people around them.
And one of the biggest forms of this is the use of charm. If you use charm and you get away with using charm, and gifted people, especially women who have this intuitive perceptiveness and charm to gain approval and praise from supervisors and seek out relationships with supervisors in order to increase their abilities to get promotions, people who use charm, they use charm, feel like the biggest phonies. They feel like, oh my God, I've nobody knows what I really feel. Mm. So when you see charming people, you could know somewhere inside they generally have quite a sense of insecurity about the way they present themselves, about the way that they are in the world. And it's people who you often wonder why they crack so easily. And they crack so easily because they're living on very thin ice.
Maybe they feel that they've only gotten to where they are because they've been so phony in, being seductive and flirtatious. And if they hadn't done that, they wouldn't have gotten to where they are, and therefore they don't deserve to be there, and so on and so forth. And I think often, Armand, these are also people who keep trying to prove themselves.
Sure.
So in reality, they probably do accomplish a lot.
You know, I think I run just a little issue with the word phony. Because phony has such a pejorative sense to it. Not themselves, I would go with. You know, because we would call it as a shortcut, we would say that. But, you know, just because somebody is not themselves...
No, I don't know. I mean, I'm just saying that sometimes a person like that could feel like a phony. I'm not saying from my perspective they are a phony.
That's right. That's right.
I'm saying
that's why I'd
like
to.
They could feel that way.
Because it's such a funny word in this world that people expose somebody as a phony. And they do that and they say, ah, you didn't tell the truth. Well, of course you didn't tell the truth. You don't have any room. Imagine if George Bush told us the truth. Oh, my God, I don't think I could handle it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, I'm going to play you a little music slightly related to this, and then we are going to continue and talk about factitious disorders. Very exciting stuff. Back with you in just a couple of minutes, my friends.
Pretending that I'm doing conceal. Oh, yes, I'm the great pretender. Just laughing and gay like a clown. I seem to be what I'm not. You see, I'm wearing my heart like a crown.
The Great Pretender by the Platters, of all things, my friends. Yes, yes, the Platters. How did we ever come up with that today? Do you think, Roberta, that you do you remember the Great Pretenders? Was that part of your childhood too? That song, or is that brand new to you?
No, I've heard it before. Yeah, it's a famous song.
Factitious disorders, Great Pretenders, a fictitious disorder. Or FD, as it's called, where the ill individual symptoms are either self-induced or falsified by a patient. Now, get this. It is faking sick. But like Roberta said, when you're a child, it's kind of, you could either fake it or not fake it. The act of the individual faking, exaggerating, or even inflicting self-injuries. Now, the state of consciousness in this act falls somewhere between conscious and unconscious, and it usually involves both. The main reasons why people develop this disorder, factitious disorder, is to assume the status of a sick person. Hence, they win over the attention, nurturance, sympathy, and even leniency that they feel they're unable to get any other way. And you know, Roberta, when I think about this, I think about sick mothers. You know, mothers who are sick, but not sick. They're not sick for their friends, but they're sick for their children.
Because they want to be taken care of, you mean?
Because they want to be taken care of. I know that in psychiatry, this applies mainly to patients. Mm-hmm. But I think very often, you know, a parent will play sick with you because they figure it's the only way they're going to get what they can to get otherwise, which is nurture and sympathy.
And see, when we were preparing for the program, Armand and I were talking about all of this, and I found it confusing for a while to find where is the fine line between someone being aware that they're pretending and someone not being aware, and how can you tell? Because, for instance, is someone who believes they're pregnant but they aren't, is that a fictitious disorder? According to what Armand is saying, no, that's not a fictitious disorder.
No, well, there are two different ways of looking at somebody who believes they're pregnant. There may be somebody who believes they're pregnant but has no symptoms. Then there's another person
right.
who believes they're pregnant, who has all the symptoms of pregnancy.
That's the one I'm talking about.
Okay, in the latter one, it is not a fictitious disorder. It is called a conversion disorder. Now, this is a distinction. Conversion disorders are one where you actually physically take on the symptom of, and it's mostly unconscious.
So you are not aware that you're faking it at all, as far as you know. And in fact, there are people, I think those are people with multiple personality, who can even, one of the personalities can have an illness, an immune system that, you know, like a cancer, and the other one does not. So here is a complete unawareness, lack of awareness that that the problem is fictitious. In the other one, the one that we're talking about, the person is slightly aware, but
it's
not
somewhere
always.
Somewhere in between. You kind of know you're faking.
And the thing is that what I suspect, Armand, is that if these people are, it's difficult for a practitioner to work with them, because if you buy into it, then it works, which means that that makes them sick.
Mm.
Like what the mother, you know, with the child. If the mother says, oh, come on, sweetie, you're fine, well, then the strategy did not work. The child is going to go to school, and the child most likely is going to be fine. But what if the mama says, oh, poor sweetheart, you're not feeling well, let me take care of you. Well, then the strategy worked,
and then the
child is sick.
Uh-huh. Which is what good mothers will do.
Right.
You know what I mean? A good mother will say, hey, my kid's sick, whether it's true or not, I'll let my kid have it. But let's go back to the definition of the fictitious disorder for a moment before we go too far away from it. In a fictitious disorder, the individuals produce or exaggerate the symptoms of either mental or physical illness. So very often, somebody who can have... I've had people walk in my office talk about hallucinations that they didn't have. And by talking about them, they actually began having hallucinations, but sometimes it just doesn't make sense. Kent Robert Shaw and I would sometimes, we would talk about people who, with their permission, of course, and we would say, you know, it just doesn't make sense. I haven't seen this. The advantage of being doing this for 40 years of my life is that sometimes things don't make sense. You know, very often I look at a movie and they present a character in the movie with a psychiatric disturbance, and I say, that doesn't make sense. People with that kind of syndrome don't behave that way. Well, in real life, people walk in and they have made up this personality, and it just doesn't make sense. So the advantage of having the experience is to see it doesn't make sense and to suspect either this is a very unusual person or it's a fictitious disorder. Now, I wanted to ask you, Roberta, as a nutritionist consultant with health, have you seen this with health? Have you seen physiological complaints that people present that they experience, but they don't completely experience? Like, they may not have the blood test to back it up, but they have the experience. Does it ever not make sense to you?
Well, sure. I think all the time that people symbolize their, you know, emotional feelings through bodily expressions of symptoms. That's something that I think anyone who works in the field of health encounters. But the fine line that one has to walk is how much do you give into that as a practitioner, which is going to make the thing worse by acknowledging it and you know, buying into it. Not that the person is trying to trick me. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is sometimes it works well to find a way to dismantle that pretension, but without hurting the person's feelings of self-esteem, because then you'll defeat the purpose. So I guess the question I have, Armand, is, are these real disorders or aren't they real disorders? Do you treat them as a real illness or not?
There is a treatment for fictitious disorders that is very specific to dealing with fictitious disorders.
And you have to pretend that one is, and you have to pretend that the patient is not ill, even though they are.
No, it's not. It's not a matter of pretense. No. But
a joke. If you work with the pretense, maybe, you know, with another pretense. No. Thank you.
Okay, I get it. I get the idea. A person with fictitious disorder very often will try to find a way to get you to believe that they have this disorder. Now, for example, just to give you an example, a urine sample, they'll collect urine samples and they'll collect them in dirty jars without knowing it. They'll do something to contaminate the sample. Now, they may know it or not know it. They could be taking certain drugs and then presenting something. They could inject themselves with bacteria to produce infections. Like when they're supposed to give themselves an injection, they may not clean the needle. They will actually create the disorder for which they'll be treated. And this is where physicians and psychiatrists and psychotherapists and nutritionists, you have to deal with something. The fact that, you know, this person is one of these people in life who may be one who does not believe that as they are, they can get what they need. So this is a person who is one of those natural animals who is just saying, I got to be different than I am to get what I need. And when you see it, the idea is not to expose them and humiliate them and say you're wrong for being this way. It's to treat it as you would treat a person who needs to be more than they are, which is most of the people who walk into my office. Now, the motives of a patient can vary. There's another one called Munchausen syndrome. The Munchausen syndrome, which is probably the dominant form of a fictitious disorder, is very specific. Who is Munchausen?
Baron Munchausen.
Baron himself.
Baron Munchausen is a character that pretended to be much more than what he was, in the sense of, you know, he described himself as being able to fly, as having won every battle that he was ever in, as being able to shoot across to the other side of the earth, as doing things that are impossible to do, and yet he would describe himself as capable of doing those things. So it's a compulsive liar in a way, but it's a particular kind of lie. It's a lie that leads to getting attention and presenting oneself as bigger, stronger, more powerful, or less so
than you really
than
are.
Than you really are.
And now Munchausen syndrome is very popular in medicine. They actually talk about this a great deal, because you're wondering if the person who is coming in has created this illness, and you have to look for that. Now, this is different, you therapists out there. This is different than another syndrome called malingering. What's the difference between malingering and Munchausen and fictitious disorder? Malingering is the patient wants to obtain an external gain, such as they want to get drugs or disability payments or to avoid an unpleasant situation such as military duty. So you know, when somebody comes to you, and many come to my office, and they want a letter or they want a drug prescription or they want to get something, you know, they can see they're just coming in. It's malingering because they're presenting symptoms to get the drugs, to get the letter, to get the jury duty letter, to get I'm going to be in the courthouse. That's malingering. That's falsifying consciously and trying to trick the doctor into giving you something that you don't truly, I can't say you need, because you do need it, but deserve. I can't even say you don't deserve it, because sometimes people are prosecuted. It's just that
It's you're trying to manipulate the doctor into doing what you want them to do to your advantage, even though you don't really need it. Because, I mean, if you don't need it, you don't need it.
So malingering is not diagnosed as a fictitious disorder, for it's not a mental disorder, but rather done in reaction to an external stimulus. It's not necessarily itself an illness. But fictitious disorder
it
is.
It means you're trying to, you actually know that you are lying, and you
and
do it anyway.
And you're exploiting the system.
Yeah.
Fictitious disorders can also, you know, we talked about conversion disorder, where you turn something into a physical illness. Hypochondriasis, which you deal with all the time, Roberta, the patient honestly believes that he or she has a particular medical disorder. And they actually contact from many physicians. These are people who go to a lot of different doctors, you know, to try to get emergency departments, hospitals, multiple physicians. And they keep going from one to the other. Patients have a verifiable medical condition, such as a pain, a gastrointestinal, sexual, or neurological symptom that cannot be fully explained by a known general medical condition or the direct effects of a substance,
well,
but they have the syndrome.
A hypochondriac, for me, is someone who you know, they hear of a description of an illness on the radio, and they start wondering if they have it. And then after a while, they think they do have it, because maybe once, a couple of months ago, they felt something that resembles something that was described. So it's someone who is overly anxious about getting every illness on the planet and finds ways to question if he or she indeed could be sick with the illness. But also, Armand, I've met people, I've worked with people who, if they think, for instance, that getting an illness, a serious one, is the only way out of a relationship that they can't get out of, or in a relationship that they can't get in, or something like that, to get other people to pay attention to them, well, even though they, you know, may not want it, but sometimes they end up getting that very illness, if they think that's the only way.
Well,
so that would be a factitious disorder, sure, right, in that case.
And one of the signs of, you know, the hypochondriasis that happens is a thing called student's disorder. And a student's illness is when you're a student of medicine, very often you think you have all of the illnesses that you're studying,
because mm-hmm.
you're studying them. If you have an obsessive compulsive tendency and you have a slight paranoia in general, like if you worry about things in general plus you're obsessive compulsive, they usually go together, you're more likely to develop these kind of hypochondriacal symptoms and this kind of thing. But we got to talk about Ganser syndrome. Now, you, my friends, those of you who are therapists living out there, how many of you know about the Ganser syndrome, G-A-N-S-E-R? You know, now this is a form of factitious disorder.
Which is not the Gander syndrome.
No, Ganser.
Ganser.
It's a reaction to extreme stress, and the patient suffers from approximation or giving absurd answers to simple questions. Now, why is this important? Because very often it looks like malingering. It looks like the person's just kind of fooling around.
Or maybe they're angry with you and they're giving you an answer that doesn't make sense.
It doesn't
angry.
Make sense. But with Ganser syndrome, the person's mind is clouded. They have conversion symptoms. They have confusion, stress, a loss of personal identity. You know, echolalia, you know, they sometimes talk in rhymes. Individuals can also give approximate answers to simple questions, like if you say, how many legs on a cat, they'll say three. And it's a Ganser syndrome, which is not that frequent, usually occurs in people somewhere around age 30 to 40 years old, somewhere in there. It happens. It's a stress reaction, and it looks like other things.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody would ever recognize Ganser syndrome because it's just not around much. You know, so there are many possible causes for all of this. The basic causes we've learned is that when you don't believe you can get something the way you are, you try to get it the way you're not.
And if you pretend for long enough, and not pretend, Armand doesn't like me to use these words, if you keep maintaining that disguise long enough, you might end up believing it yourself.
Well, let's explain that, Roberta. You know, I think we use so many words that sound like we have a latent judgment, even though I know you don't. And I know you're one of the least judgmental people in the world. So if you pretend and if you, you know, make up a personality to us, we understand. If you don't tell the truth about yourself, we understand. You know, now, if you're a mate on the other side of this and you have a mate who's not telling you the truth, that's very, very difficult. But the fact that you got related to somebody who feels insecure, who doesn't feel safe in telling the truth, that's part of what you learn over time. Now, the ideal in life, the dream in life, each human who I believe everybody in some way makes believe, I think everybody does, Robert, in one way or another. The dream in life is one day you find a mate, you find a person, two people, a best friend, a mate, somebody you can be yourself with, so that you kind of settle down. And you know, everybody knows that feeling. You know the feeling of what it's like to truly be yourself in front of somebody you love. And it could be a best friend. It could be your mother, you know, if you have it with her. It could be or it could be your lover or your
could
wife.
Could be your pet.
Yes, I guess you're right.
For some people.
for some people, that's the place where you feel it.
Sure.
Where can I really be me, you know?
And it feels completely safe. Like, no matter what you do, no matter how bad you smell at times, no matter how sad you might be, no matter what, you know that this individual or creature loves you just the same. It doesn't make any difference whatsoever. That's an incredible feeling to have, and I hope everyone at some point gets to experience it.
With either a mate, a friend, or a pet.
Yeah, with...
You know
with,
what I think
you know,
about sometimes,
just to
Roberta,
experience that feeling.
I think about refugees. I'm not going to talk about the refugee syndrome, but I think about people who are the refugees of a war like the war in Iraq, who are kind of walking on the roads and never have a safe spot anywhere, and they're not sure who they should be at any given point. There is no truth. What should they say? Do you say the town you came from? And every minute along the way as a refugee, you're wondering, what story do I have to tell? Who do I have to be so I could just live long enough to get through the next spot?
I bet that's what people felt like in concentration camps.
Sure.
And that's why sometimes people would form an alliance with the oppressors, because maybe that was the only way that they could be accepted, just, and, you know, utilized. You know, if you become useful to the one who oppresses you, then maybe you'll survive. It comes down to survival. And yes, as humans, we probably are the best at this game, Armand.
And sometimes it's used to exploit. You know, sometimes the fakeness is used to exploit, like when somebody puts up and says, you know, it's orange alert, let's go kill some Iraqis. You know, that's using
it. It's used like that a lot.
It's used, we will use an imitation. We are now, you know, if you look in the subway today. The other day I was trying to go to work and there were these, like, thousands of police. And I said, what were you doing? He said, we're doing a terrorist deterrent. I said, well, what terrorists are you trying to deter? And he said to me, actually, he says, we're trying to use up our union time. And I said, I don't know what it meant, but I knew they had the calling it a terrorist deterrent.
My goodness.
And it was on, I think it was Monday morning. The place was just, Tuesday morning. It was just jammed. It was hundreds and hundreds of police
and
commandos.
Don't get me started.
But we'll create the illusion. But we have to keep in mind, people love illusions. People love magic. People love tricks. People love things to not be what they are.
Of course.
So there's all sides of it. And humans have learned to falsify. And they've become experts at it. There are people who have jobs. You know, when you have a cold caller, somebody who you hire to answer phones or to make phone calls, you hire them for their ability to lie. If you give people loan insurance, we had an article here, we had a show the other day about loans being given to people who buy homes and buy apartments and how falsified these lenders are and what they do to kind of get you, convince you to take out a loan. It's like it's all mirrors. Now, do you say to yourself, I hate the people who falsely represent themselves? Well, if you're going to make peace with yourself in this world, my friends, you make peace with the part of you that needs you have to falsify yourself and with those that need to falsify. Because once you see it, once you learn it, once you accept it, you don't have to be a part of it, you don't have to tolerate it, you don't have to invest your money, but you make more peace with yourself and you find those genuine people, the people who you can love and trust, where you can, or the pets, that you can love and trust, where you can truly learn to be yourself.
Mm.
You know, and that's what I think great therapists are for and great people in the profession are for.
And you know what I think, Armand? Just to top even what you just said, is that eventually it's nice when people get to know themselves so well that they get to that point where they can give themselves that kind of approval, even when they are alone, that they can say, you know what, yeah, maybe I have pretended this and I've had done that, but it's safe to be me with my limitations and imperfections, and I'm not going to beat myself up for it. I'm not going to berate myself because why? You know, that's a waste of time or whatever. Don't you think we get there eventually?
I sure do. I think that's the advantage of age, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You get old enough to be yourself.
I think there's a lot of advantages with age, Armand.
Well, that's another show. This is Armand DeMille and Roberta Maria Aki. Be back with you next week, and I'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., bringing you a very program about people who are interested in making a statement about the situation in the world today. So if you want a copy of today's program, you go to thepositivemind.com or WBAI.org. Roberta, your website is?
CreativeHealthSolutions.org.
Be back with you tomorrow, my friends.